This is the English Heritage Podcast.
Hello, and thank you for downloading or streaming this latest podcast into England's past. I'm Charles Rowe. Make sure you hit the subscribe button to receive brand new episodes to your chosen podcast feed every Thursday. Today we're talking about King Henry V, who is famous for his victory over the French at the 1415 Battle of Agincourt, also his military abilities during the Hundred Years' War with France, and the Shakespeare play named after him. And joining me to reveal more about this celebrated medieval king and the time he spent at Kenilworth Castle in Warwickshire are our guests, Emeritus Professor of Medieval History at the University of Southampton, Anne Curry, and Head Historic Properties Curator, Dr. Jeremy Ashby. Turning to Anne first, when we talk about King Henry V, could you remind us what period of history we're talking about?
Yeah, well, Henry V was King of England from the 21st of March 1413 to his death in Vincennes on the 31st of August 1422. And I think we're going to be focusing mainly on him. But of course, he was born in 1386. So we need to look a little bit about what's happening before he becomes king in 1413. What I think is interesting, of course, about Henry, when I first started looking at him, when he was a boy and a teenager, he's called the young Lord Henry. He was a member of a collateral line of the royal family. The royal family, rather like today, you know, was a big royal family because Edward III had had a number of sons. The main line is his son was the Edward of Woodstock, better known as the Black Prince. So his grandson, Richard II, inherited because the Black Prince died before his father, Edward III. You've then got a second line, essentially the Earls of March, and then the third line, John of Gaunt, the Duke of Lancaster, the fourth line from which the Dukes of York descended, the fifth line, Duke of Gloucester. So all of them had kids, and therefore there's quite a big royal family. And our young Lord Henry is the grandson of John of Gaunt, the third son of Edward III. And as John of Gaunt was Duke of Lancaster, so Henry, young Lord Henry, is a Lancastrian, as is his father, Henry Bolingbroke, better known, of course, as the usurper Henry IV.
Ah, okay. So there's quite a lot of backstory to go through, isn't there, really?
A great deal, yes.
And before Henry does become king, what can you tell us about his early life? You've talked about sort of the lines there, but do we know much about his youth?
Yeah, we do, because everybody kept very good financial records, like keeping a record of all the pocket money he was given, that sort of thing. So we know quite a lot about even a kind of medieval baby grow bought for him in his early years. We know about his nurses. We know about those who are close to him. A chap called John Melbourne, for instance, who seems very active in looking after him in the late 1390s. So we see quite a lot from those records. And he would have grown up as a young noble. So he was well educated. We know books of Latin grammar were bought for him. We know he had a pet greyhound, things of this sort. So there's quite a lot of colour about his upbringing there. He has three brothers and two sisters. And again, we can kind of track them. And he didn't have any thought, I'm sure, as a boy of becoming King of England. He would have gone on, no doubt, to have served in wars like the nobility did. And he would have had lands. He was poised to inherit the great Duchy of Lancaster that had been given to his grandfather, John of Gaunt. But even so, he would not have been king. And that's what's quite remarkable about him, that he's not a man born to be king.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, really, because it seemed from what you were describing at the start with the three different lines that he seemed quite far away from achieving that.
He did indeed. And of course, that was to go on to cause difficulties. Essentially, the Wars of the Roses are caused by the deposition of Richard II in 1399. Now, there was no doubt that Richard II was the legitimate King of England as the son of the son of the eldest son of Edward III. But he is deposed in 1399 by a cousin, but a cousin from the third line. And there were potential heirs, the Earl of March, in the second line of descent from Edward IV. And later on, that second line is to marry with the fourth line. And that's really what created the heady circumstances that led to the Wars of the Roses in the middle of the 15th century. But that's to come. what about 1399 itself and the deposition of Richard II? Well, Richard II had a troubled reign, particularly as it went on and he became more autocratic in the way he ruled, and he fell out with a good number of his nobles, amongst whom was his cousin Henry Bolingbroke, who was Earl of Derby, in fact made Duke of Hereford as well. And it all really came to a head in 1398, where there were accusations of disloyalty, and there was going to be a big duel between Henry Bolingbroke and Thomas Mowbray at that point. But the king put paid to that. He said, no, you can't fight. I'll send you both into exile. That's what he did. So in 1398, young Lord Henry's father, Henry Bolingbroke, is in exile in France, but he plots to return to England, possibly just to take the Duchy of Lancaster, because when his father, John of Gaunt, died early in 1399, Richard probably made a big mistake and said, well, I'm not going to let you have it, Henry Bolingbroke, you can stay in exile. And that's really what got him annoyed. Nobles believed they had a right to these lands and titles. So Henry Bolingbroke invaded England, ostensibly to get the Duchy of Lancaster, but went that bit further and managed to get control of Richard to depose him. He was fortunate in that Richard actually was in Ireland at the time he invaded. He'd gone over to Ireland to fight against the Irish warlords, and he'd taken our young Lord Henry with him, so almost like a hostage there. And in fact, our young Lord Henry is still in Ireland when Henry Bolingbroke's doing all of this, trying to get control of Richard. And then he's summoned back to England by his father. And lo and behold, his father's made king. He has a coronation. Our young Lord Henry is a prince carrying a sword at the coronation. And in Parliament in October 1399, he's made Prince of Wales. He's made Duke of Cornwall. He's made Earl of Chester. He's made Duke of Aquitaine. He's also, for good measure, made Duke of Lancaster. So it's a hell of a transformation within a few months in 1399. And so we have the beginning of the Lancastrian dynasty with Henry IV and the Prince of Wales, the future Henry V.
And am I right in saying, from what you've been describing there, that the future Henry V is in England, but his father is exiled? So that's a strange situation, isn't it?
Yes, he is in England, but then he's taken by Richard on the campaign to Ireland. Well, I think Richard, you know, kept a couple of these boys as sort of hostages. But it's also interesting on a personal front. When he was in exile, Henry Bolingbroke had with him his second son, Thomas, who later became Duke of Clarence. There has been an argument that Henry Bolingbroke didn't have a terribly good relationship later with the Prince of Wales, but he always had a very good relationship with the second son, even to the point in 1412, there were big fallings out between Henry IV and the Prince of Wales, even to rumours that he was going to pass over his eldest son for the inheritance to the crown and have Prince Thomas made king instead. Not very likely that was going to happen, but it's quite interesting. Those were rumours going around at the time.
And this deposing of the previous king, Richard, how was that taken by the public? You know, because it all sounds like a bit of a mess, really.
Yeah, well, I think Richard had elements that were unpopular, some arbitrary government, people having to pay for things and all of that kind of stuff. I mean, I think Henry also was lucky that he got control of Richard easily. Richard, coming back from Ireland, rushed up to Cheshire because that's where his power base was. He'd made the Earldom of Chester into a Palatinate, a principality of Chester, and so he was hoping to get a lot of military support there, but he was too late. Bolingbroke got there before him, effectively, and he was able to arrest Richard. Richard then didn't have an army, and the Duke of York, from that fourth line, was the sort of protector of England at the time, gave in to Bolingbroke. So Bolingbroke starts off quite well with the support of a lot of the nobility. Okay, there are rebellions against him. In fact, the whole reign really is insecure in terms of that kind of thing. The very famous one is the rebellion of the Percy family, and in 1403, the Battle of Shrewsbury, where Henry Hotspur, the son of the Earl of Northumberland, the Percy Earl of Northumberland, wages a battle against Henry IV and Prince of Wales. He's defeated, But that sort of shows the level to which opposition to Henry IV could develop. And at that battle too, the Prince of Wales is wounded in the face by an arrow. So it's a real coming of age in terms of military experience.
I see. Yes. What was Henry doing during his father's reign then? I understand that wasn't there some conflict with Wales as well?
A lot. And inevitably, as Prince of Wales, he's going to be involved in that. Yes, in 1400, essentially, Owen Glendower declared that he was Prince of Wales. And there were wars going on really for the next decade. Glendower was very successful. His men seized many of even those great castles that had been built by Edward I, and he had a lot of support in Wales. Wales, I'm sure people know it, has a lot of very sort of deep valleys and things. It's quite isolated settlements, including Glendower's own seat, and therefore it wasn't that easy to fight a war in Wales. The Prince of Wales, we have a lot of letters from him at that point, complaining he hasn't got any oats for his horses, complaining also he's running out of money to pay his troops, he's having to pawn his own jewels in order to do it. And of course he could never find Glendower, and Glendower was never found, he was never captured. So when Henry set sail for France in 1415, he'd sent people into Wales to try to find Glendower, to try to broker peace, you know, didn't want any trouble while he was away in France. They couldn't find him, likely he was dead by then. But that Welsh War was very much the military apprenticeship of Henry V. That said, he wasn't all that successful in it. He made some mistakes in it. He perhaps was being too merciful, for instance, at the Siege of Aberystwyth in 1406, and he let Glendower get into Aberystwyth. So while we look back and we see Henry V as a very successful warrior against the French, those Welsh wars, he wasn't so successful. Another thing about that, Henry IV started becoming quite ill. Now, if you were Prince of Wales, you'd be worried your dad was going to die while you were stuck at a siege in Aberystwyth. Yeah, and so he wasn't always there. And Parliament sometimes were sort of commenting on this and saying he should get back to those wars in Wales. He shouldn't be in London. But of course, he was in London because he was worried his dad was going to die and he would become king, and he wanted to be on the spot if that was going to happen.
I see. How long did these Welsh wars go on for?
Well, they start in 1400, and I think by 1409, things are subdued, but they're never wholly subdued. And we find lots of troops are kept in the old garrisons, old castles in Wales.
As Anne has said, because Owen Glendower was never caught, the wars sort of, you know, fizzle out. But it, you know, must have been a terrible, you know, remember that Henry is I think he's 16 when this breaks out. Mm-hmm. So he's not really very old. And actually, as well as this having to campaign across this quite difficult territory, he also has this very thankless task of having to supply these castles that are on the other side of Snowdonia. It's very, very hard to get supplies and men and weaponry to. And I know there's a lot of letters back from people at, say, Harlech Castle, which is a particularly difficult one to get to, that say, you know, we've got five men and we've got, you know, two helmets between us and things. What are you going to do about it? So it's a very serious bit of upbringing for a young prince. And in a sense, it's not really surprising that our Henry wasn't a great success really at it, because it was a very tough thing to be doing.
What was he like personality-wise? Do we have any accounts about that?
I do think he was a bit of a wayward prince. I think this staying in London is part of that. You know the Shakespeare Henry IV parts 1 and 2, where the prince is really quite rebellious against his father and has a lifestyle that is not meet for the warrior prince. I think there's a lot of truth in that. The reason I think that is that on his accession, the chronicles talk about his transformation, really, his transformation to becoming a very, very serious-minded king, wholly aware of the obligations of kingship. It could be deemed almost a religious conversion as well. The chronicles tell us of visiting his father's deathbed with expressions of guilt there about not being a good son. And also visiting the recluse of Westminster, you know, sort of confessing his sins and essentially, you know, saying that was the past. now as the future, even putting away at that point when he becomes king in 1413, putting away those friends of his youth, much as in the Shakespeare plays, and now intending to rule, as I say, as a very serious-minded king. Quite interestingly, the men he chooses for his friends and counsel at the beginning of his reign are all older men, very much not tarred with this brush of being mates of the prince when he was younger. And Henry goes on very soon in his reign to found monasteries. You know, that's a sort of expression very much of a newfound piety. And he stamps out Lollardy, the heresy in England, where there's been some suggestions he'd been quite sort of sympathetic to reform of the church while he was prince, not so when he's king. He's very much an establishment king in that respect. So I think that transformation can be shown by lots of sources, which of course means there's got to be something to transform from, I think, when he was prince.
Yes, and what was he transforming from apart from being rebellious? Was he a bit of a spoilt brat or a bit of a playboy or...?
It's hard to pin down the actual details of this. There were later stories of him even being involved in a robbery in London, but I think he is in London a lot. We know he was the early owner of a manuscript of Troilus and Cressida by Chaucer. This was what we might call the sort of racy literature of the period. So he was a modern prince, if you like, with unsuitable friends who perhaps liked drinking a lot, maybe womanizing too. Well, again, it's difficult to pin down any detail of this, but just to note one life of him written admittedly in the 1430s, but with knowledge of people who'd been in his company earlier, to say that although under the military service of Mars, he seethed youthfully with the flames of Venus too, and tended to be open to other novelties as befitted the age of his untamed youth. So I think he was very much a modern prince in the reign of his father.
But he really grew into the role as soon as he was on the throne, really.
He did, he did. And I think we've got to remember as well, maybe this was a good story, that transformation, because the interest in the royals was like today. But he had also shown great bravery. Remember at the Battle of Shrewsbury in 1403, he'd been injured in the face, wounded in the face by an arrow. And that arrow head was very difficult to remove. And we know quite a bit from John Bradmore, the surgeon who invented a tool to take out the arrowhead to avoid it remaining in the cheek and the wound going septic. And that brings in Kenilworth, I think, Jeremy, as well, doesn't it? Because we know that operation happened, and Henry went to recuperate at Kenilworth and was probably there for quite a long time. So I think his affection for Kenilworth maybe goes back to that period of great bravery. The chronicles tell us there that he led his men very bravely. He, even after he'd been wounded, he wouldn't leave the field. So although there are a lot of negative things to say about this prince, there's also some evidence of his military command and his personal bravery.
It's almost like he's indebted to Kenilworth Hospital, so to speak.
I think it's rather interesting that it didn't put him off, because I think for some people, you know, this rather ghastly surgery of having an arrow head removed from your face might be something that you wouldn't want to think back on. But I think it is a great testimony to the safety and comfort of Kenilworth Castle. And I think probably, you know, throughout his life, that would have been what the association would be, that this is a place where he could be comfortable, in a sense, you know, still on duty, but in a beautiful and luxurious castle in the centre of England. It has many, you know, things that would appeal.
So he's recuperating there while Prince of Wales, before he becomes Henry V, effectively, and this is about 10 years before his crowning, while he's got this wound. Is that right?
That's right.
So for people who are interested in looking at Kenilworth Castle as we're talking about it right now, they might want to open up a tab on their internet browser and have a look if they're not familiar with it. But it's in the West Midlands in the county of Warwickshire, which is Shakespeare's county, famously.
It's in the geographical centre of England, if you like. That's probably the way that I would like to think about it, at least emotionally, if not actually completely geographically. It's in the county of Warwickshire. It's quite close to the then, you know, very prosperous city of Coventry. It's quite close to the town of Warwick. It's quite close to the town of Stratford-on-Avon, which is, of course, about to become famous, but isn't quite yet at the moment. So it's in that part of the country. And Kenilworth Castle then, in a sense, we still get some sense of this, though it's been ruined since the 17th century, was a magnificent castle. It was comfortable. It was very large. And it was relatively up to date. Now, Kenilworth Castle was in the family because Henry V was the son of Henry IV, who was the son of John of Gaunt, the Duke of Lancaster. And it was John who, in the last years of the 14th century, had turned the already quite luxurious Kenilworth Castle into one of the most luxurious and grand palaces of England and probably of Europe. It's certainly on that kind of scale. And though it wasn't in those days a royal castle, I think that it was almost certainly quite closely based on some fairly outstanding buildings that Edward III had built at Windsor Castle. There seemed to have been some similarities in the way that the palace was laid out, with a great hall, with a whole succession of chambers of increasing privacy and presumably comfort and luxury leading off from that in a long line. This was something that was actually quite new at that time, and Kenilworth Castle was absolutely up there in the height of fashion. So it doesn't surprise me in the slightest that as prince and later on as king, I think it probably is fair to say that Kenilworth Castle was among Henry V's favourite places.
And the way that we see it today, obviously, as this ruin, which is as a result of, I believe, the Civil War, isn't it? Or the Civil Wars.
That's right, yeah.
In England. How would it appear in, you know, the early 1400s?
Well, I mean, one of the lucky things about Kenilworth is that once you've got your eye in, you can actually see what you're looking at. But you're right, it is ruined. And it's also, we have to note that the castle had had a bit of a makeover later in the 16th century under Robert Dudley, the Earl of Leicester, who was trying to marry Elizabeth I and get her to come and stay. So that's a filter with which you've got to see things. But there's still enough to get the sense, first of all, the buildings are very big. Secondly, there are a lot of them. And I think this is an age when actually the architecture of the greatest houses is getting more complicated, that once upon a time they would have been satisfied with a reasonably small number of large rooms in which you did a lot of different things in the same space. Now they're actually getting much more specialized. So from the end of the Great Hall, you'd go into a great chamber, which looked pretty much like a great hall. It had an enormous bay window at one end. It had fireplaces. It was quite comfortable. But then from there, you'd go not straight into your bedroom, but actually you'd have three or four rooms in the middle, you know, in the meantime. And off these spaces would have been other sort of small, more private rooms where you could, you know, relax and eat and drink. You could do business there. You could have your collection of books. You could actually listen to music. So this would be a place that you could do business, but it would also be a place where you actually could indulge all the greatest artistic and cultural pursuits that characterize the age. And I think, I mean, you know, I'd be interested in Anne's view about this, but I think, you know, in order to look the part of a king, you haven't just got to be, you know, strong and forceful. You've actually got to be culturally quite sophisticated. You've got to have around you clever people, and you've got to have fine artworks, and you've got to have fine music. This is all part of the toolkit of a successful European monarch. Would you say that's fair?
Yeah, I'd certainly agree. I think Henry V also is a very, very clever chap. He's well educated. He's a sort of multidimensional. Jeremy mentioned music. It's thought that he might have composed two pieces, a Gloria and a Sanctus. We have the manuscript with Marc Leroy Henry. Some dispute as to whether it was his father, but it is more likely to be Henry. And these Lives of Henry, written in the 1430s, also comment on his musical abilities. I have wondered sometimes whether the play on the word organ, you know, given his sexual proclivities, is double-edged. But we know he played the lute. We know when he was in France, he sent over for some instruments. He had a large group of minstrels and performers with him. There's been a huge amount of interest in music at his court. There are many musical works connected with the celebrations of the victory at Agincourt, and also recently, there's been work on the music specially composed for the celebrations of the Treaty of Troyes in 1420 and his marriage to Catherine in Troyes as well. So it's a very, the soundscape, I think, of his reign would have been quite notable too.
So and what I think that means is that Kenilworth Castle would have been a very multi-sensory experience, with the best of everything. And I certainly do get the sense that Henry is acutely aware of his own creature comforts, but also needing to look the part, which I think is quite important when we actually get to the story of some of the things that happened at Kenilworth.
All the trappings of high entertainment and high culture and all the rest of it. And crucially, one thing that we haven't described is that the perimeter, the castle walls, they would have been surrounded by what's called a mere, in other words, a large body of water. So that makes it even more exclusive, just from a geographical perspective.
Absolutely, yeah, it does. Now, that's not new. That's actually something that had been a feature of the castle, actually for many centuries before it got there. And we castle people are actually quite undergoing still something of a transformation in the way that we look at castles now, whereas once upon a time, you would assess the stone buildings, and particularly you'd think about, how strong would that be if it were attacked from this angle with this weapon? Actually, now we don't think of castles that way, and Kenilworth is the absolute type site of what we sometimes call a landscape of lordship, which is to say that you don't just think of the stone buildings, grand though these ones were, you actually think of all of the bits that go with it around the outside. So there's the mere, which is this enormous body of fresh water. It would obviously have some economical value. It would have some defensive value. It makes the castle difficult to get to. But it would also be visually rather impressive that the walls of the castle being reflected in the water, looking like a sort of fairy tale fortress. I think, that this is not a modern idea. They think about that. And then around the outside of that, there would actually also have been other land in which they could indulge in the archetypal medieval leisure pursuit to go hunting. And Kenilworth always seems to have been a very popular kind of place for that. So it's a quite interesting and varied thing. But Kenilworth Castle was really up there with the best of them. And being in this useful part of England, I think that it would have had many appeals on Henry.
Definitely.
It's interesting as well that when Henry came back to England briefly in the spring of 1421, after he'd married Catherine, he wanted to have her crowned queen, he takes her there in March of 1421. It was a very special place, I think, for Henry. And it's even possible that the future Henry VI was conceived at.
Yes, you can play the game of counting 9 months, but it does work. So, yes, one can well imagine.
Yes, and this mere, I've got a picture which I found on the Discovering Britain website, which is pretty impressive. It's a colour picture, and the mere is vast, and there are in fact two crossings to access the castle. One looks almost as long as the grounds itself.
Yes. Now, the water went in the 17th century, although in certain weather conditions, bits of the fields around do flood because it's still absolutely flat. So that happens. But yeah, you're right that the access to the castle was very impressive because you had to come at it. The principal gateway was coming across this quite long causeway. In later years, they actually used the causeway as a tilt yard for jousting. But it's in our Henry time, we can imagine him on his horse. And of course, all of the enormous entourage that follows the king around, which I sometimes think, when you sort of, a big rock band going on tour, that's the kind of thing you have to imagine. Loads of lorries, loads of people, outriders with trumpets, clearing the road in the front. It's the king moving around is a very impressive spectacle. And of course, it culminates with, him taking possession of this castle that belongs to him and then going into these incredibly comfortable apartments. However, Kenilworth has one other rather interesting attribute, which isn't in the castle, but is in Kenilworth, which is that there was an outstation to the castle, which we know that Henry himself actually built. Now, this is a place that's called the Pleasance, and it's not desperately well documented, but there are sort of occasional references to it from quite early, but also then through the 15th and into the 16th century. And what it seems to be was that Henry had created a place just around the corner from Kenilworth Castle where he would be even more secluded. He would be able to get away from it. And I'm indebted to Anne, who found me this absolutely glorious quotation, which if I may be permitted, I'd actually quite like to read it because it's really fantastic. And it's from this source called the Liber Metricus, chapter 11. how the Lord King spent Lent in the castle of Kenilworth, and how in the marsh where foxes hid among the prickly bushes and thorns, he established a pleasure garden for his relaxation, as though foreseeing that he would manfully expel the trickery of the French from his kingdom, along with other enemy plots. And in that place he built a most pleasant place, which he caused to be called Pleasant Marais. Marais is the French word for a marsh. So what he's doing is having something that where he can get away from it all. Even if Kenilworth is like getting away from it all, if you're imagining that the centre of things is in Westminster, he's actually going even for one stage further removed. And I mean, rather sadly, this place doesn't exist anymore, but we know exactly where it was, and there's still some things to see on the ground. The way that you get there is on the north side of the castle, which is where Leicester's gatehouse is, and there's a part of the very, you know, pretty part of the town of Kenilworth is actually just facing you. You walk westwards, you go along the north front of the castle, and there's a public footpath. I think it's actually signed that says "To the Pleasance." And you walk probably for about 20 minutes through, I have to say, very, very pleasant open countryside. Breathe the fresh air, listen to the sound of the birds and all that kind of thing. And eventually you will emerge at a much more open area where there are these very large earthworks, banks and ditches. And what they were the creation of Henry as the platform surrounded by a water-filled ditches, but right on the edge of the mere. And there's actually a bit where the earthworks are a bit more complicated. We think that's quite likely that there was some kind of wooden dock there. So actually, probably the way that it worked is Henry didn't go down this footpath. Henry got into a boat at the back of Kenilworth Castle, where there was a water gate, and he had himself rowed across. And actually, as you go round the corner, if you did this, you'd finally disappear from view. Even a watchman on the battlements of Kenilworth Castle can't actually see the Pleasance, and that's where Henry might go and hide out. What we know about the palace, there've been the Pleasance, there've been surveys in the past, and there are a few descriptions, and we actually, a little bit of it survived into the 16th century. It was actually taken down and moved into inside Kenilworth Castle, though it doesn't exist anymore. The bulk of the building seems to have been made of timber, quite lightweight, but it had quite a lot of rooms. I think the best guess is that actually it formed a quadrangular enclosure, probably square, with brick or stone towers on each of the corners. And probably in the centre of all of that, this garden. And that's really important, that gardening. This is rather interesting because it's in a slightly wider context of something that kings had always been particularly keen on, to actually relax and enjoy the pleasures of gardens and to build themselves sort of fairly private residences in which, you know, you could have your bedroom directly, you know, next to the garden. So you get up in the morning and you come down and, you know, enjoy the flowers and all that kind of thing. You know, this may seem, you know, a little bit incongruous for the victor of the Battle of Agincourt. But I think, you know, if there's one theme about this entire podcast, it's that the Henry V of Shakespeare, who's a little bit, you know, one-dimensional, he's a great warrior, isn't even the half of the story. He's a much more interesting and complex person. We've had him as the composer of fine and complex music. Now we've got him as an innovative gardener.
I think also it points to the sort of cerebral nature of Henry. Later on in that quote, Jeremy, it said that here in the Pleasance, the king premeditated on the troubles which would afflict his realm and how its strengths might be increased. So I think he's there. It's almost an away day, if you like, for the king, maybe several days thinking about things. It's where he had his best thoughts.
Yeah.
In amazing luxury as well. I mean, if you thought Kenilworth Castle was a fantastic place to live, then this Pleasance sounded like just a slightly smaller version, more intimate, discreet and secret.
Yeah, I think that, I think intimate and discreet, I like the sound of that. Yeah, that's probably about right. It's not so grand. I mean, clearly, though, the garden itself actually seems to have been quite large. And I mean, you know, when you walk around this platform, you think, oh, that's pretty big. You know, it's as big as a castle. But Kenilworth Castle absolutely dwarfs it. And I get the feeling that he's doing something a bit different here.
I think so. I don't think there are any precedents, not even Richard II, who was quite into display. I think this is a very different sort of private monarchy. And of course, it plays a role, I think, in the lead up to the invasion of France in 1415. Because it would seem it's the place to which the Dauphin of France sent an insult to Henry. I don't know whether Jeremy wants to sort of say more. Whether
let's do it between us, but in a way, it's one of the more fateful things, isn't it? And of course, Shakespeare picks up on all of this as well.
Yes, intriguingly.
I think, you know, that there's background, and I kind of need Anne to do this, that France was already on the agenda. I think that's very important.
Henry was pretty obsessed by invading France. So his father had had a go at it in 1412. I mean, they were encouraged, the English, by the fact that the French were in a state of civil war between the Armagnac and Burgundian factions for control of the king. Charles VI suffered from mental instability, and therefore you're getting lots of faction fighting to control the king. And so Henry IV and Henry V think this is a good time to invade France. There's lots of embassies going on. In fact, you can see this almost as soon as he becomes king, Henry V starts sending embassies, and the French send embassies back. And he does eventually invade in the summer of 1415. But it seems that in Lent of 1414, where, as we can see, Henry seems to be in Kenilworth, the Dauphin, the eldest son, the heir to the throne in France, then the Dauphin Louis, sent a chest of tennis balls to Henry. And when these were explained to him, it was because the Dauphin was saying that Henry was more fit to play games with his boys, as he calls them in the text, and also to sleep on comfortable cushions than he was to make war. So it was a great insult, although I think it's linked to the fact that Henry had not been that successful in the wars in Wales. Henry V did not have a reputation as a great warrior when he became king. He's going to forge that later on. So the Dauphin was really pointing out an Achilles heel in Henry. And it's a great insult, this, and Shakespeare, of course, writes it even better than that. But it gives Henry the opportunity to retort and to say that those might be tennis balls, but he will send balls against towns and cities in France, and the French will know he's arrived. In other words, he will respond with cannonballs, he will respond with war. So these little stories in medieval chronicles, of which this is one, gives Henry an opportunity to insult the French. Now, there have been big debates as to whether it's true or not, but I see no reason for thinking it isn't. It's not an invented thing. There's something happened at Kenilworth in the spring of 1414. And I think Henry was insulted, and it then added to his ammunition, if you'll excuse the pun, for preparing the invasion of France in 1415, which was big scale. The army that he took in 1415 was 12,000 strong, the biggest since 1346, when Edward III had gone to France and beaten the French at Crecy. So I think it's part of the build-up to this invasion.
And there's something rather significant about all of this in the question of whether or not it's true, which is that one of the very early sources that we have from this is written by an Augustinian canon called John Streach. And John Streach was an Augustinian canon in the priory at Kenilworth, which is, you know, it's about 300 yards away from Kenilworth Castle. Now, Streach doesn't say this happened at Kenilworth, but the fact that there's other sources that are also talking about Kenilworth, and this man was in a very good position to know what was going on. So you really do have to think, actually, it's a circumstantial case that places it here, and it must be said that Shakespeare has this happen in the Royal Palace in London, but there it is. And I believe it too. I think that everything that we know about Henry's affection for the place, the fact that we have other documentary sources that place him there, and the fact that Canon John Streach is one of the people who writes about this most fully and most early, really does make a quite strong case for it.
I think even if you look at the timeline of events as well, just taking notes from what you've both been saying, 1413, Henry V is crowned. 1414 is potentially this reception of the tennis ball insult. And then 1415 is the Battle of Agincourt. So it all happens quite quickly.
It does. Yes. Henry, though, takes quite a long time to persuade his nobles to go to war. We kind of always assume what the king said, everybody did. There's quite an important meeting in November 1414 in Parliament where Henry's Chancellor sort of reads out a statement explaining why now is a good time to invade France and what benefits will come from that. And we know from then onwards, Henry is really quite taken with raising money for the campaign and also trying to indent troops, to enter into contracts with troops. We get those contracts at the end of April. That's when they're finally written up, and we see him developing that very big army. And then it mustering in the Southampton area in early July. So clearly a war like this, like a Royal Progress, takes a hell of a lot of preparation. Even at a soldier level, the troops had to take 3 months' food with them. So they had a lot of carts and stuff with them as well. Live animals are taken as well. Think of the thousands of horses that are going to go. So the level of preparation for this is absolutely huge. And war has to be funded out of taxation or out of loans. So there's a lot of money raising going on as well in the lead up to this campaign.
Yes, and I suppose it's also got to be the summer as well, because that's the battling season, isn't it? You can't really be doing this in autumn or winter.
I think that's right. I think Henry wanted to land in France on the 1st of August. He does that in 1417 in his second campaign. And I've pondered it, that's the feast of St. Peter Ad Vincula. I think what he was doing was putting forward a notion that he was liberating the Normans from the chains of the French. Mm. He was very much keen on developing this idea of an independent duchy of Normandy, much more explicitly in 1417, where he starts calling himself Duke of Normandy. But you might even see it in 1415, because his first target is the town of Harfleur, which he besieges. He signed up his soldiers for 12 months, so it does look as though very much in 1415, as in 1417, his idea is to conquer Normandy. In 1415, that siege isn't easy, it goes on for too long, and he decides to leave France. But on the way from Harfleur to Calais, he's marching there, he's difficulty crossing the Somme, he has to go a long way inland. The French decide to intercept him, which they do at the French village of Azincourt, not that far south of Calais, actually. And of course, the rest is history. He wins that battle against the odds. And although he comes home quite quickly afterwards, the French had never dared to face him in battle again. So Shakespeare rushes us straight from the victory at Agincourt to the Treaty of Troyes. There's a lot of warfare happens in between, but even so, something that really places Henry now in the ascendant in Europe, revises all those impressions people had of him as not a very effective warrior. The Battle of Agincourt is extremely important. And by the way, it means you can get loads of money from Parliament to fund further campaigns as well. So it removes a lot of his monetary problems.
Yes, the Battle of Agincourt, we call it, 1415, and Azincourt, as you said, in French, which is interesting how they've swapped the G for a Z. But there you go. And in fact, just looking on the internet search engines, you can see some pictures that tourists have taken of the site. And in fact, there's a tall kind of headstone memorial with a soldier depicted on it, and it says in French, "To those who have no grave, Azincourt, 1415 to 2015.
That was put up by Agincourt 600, which I was chair of the charity in 2015, because we had the 600th anniversary of Agincourt, and there was a lot of activities on both sides of the channel, a lot of research as well on the battle. If people are interested, there's a site called medievalsoldier.org that has the names of 250,000 English soldiers in the late 14th and early 15th centuries, and also a special section on Agincourt 600, listing all of the retinues, listing quite a lot of the French army as well, and looking at all the prisoners and evidence of the burials of the French dead and things of this sort. So yeah, it's a battle of which we actually have a vast amount of information, particularly in the National Archives.
What did it do for Henry as a king then?
Well, it's a second transformation. It makes him an important figure in Europe, really. And also, as I said, it enables Henry to have plenty of money to have another invasion of France in 1417 with an equally large army. And he spends the next 2 years, 1417 to 19, conquering Normandy, a great siege of Rouen, 6 month siege, 1418 to 19, and then taken. Rouen is the largest place ever taken by siege in the whole of the Hundred Years' War. And Henry then goes on, threatens Paris, is able to exploit the civil war in France, where it's come to a head, where the Armagnacs kill the Duke of Burgundy. And as often been said, it's through the hole in the Duke of Burgundy's head that the English enter France. Henry then is accepted by the French as their saviour, and he becomes heir and regent of France by the Treaty of Troyes in 1420. So it's quite remarkable, really, Henry's success in France. Those 5 years, 1415 to 20, are the most remarkable of any English king, and indeed many generals as well in later periods, in effecting a conquest, winning over hearts and minds as well, and becoming a popular regent of France after 1420.
I understand that there were some other English heritage sites that played their part in the invasion of France in 1415 before the battle took place. Could you tell us about these, Jeremy?
Yeah, we've just got to go back a bit. But, I mean, as Anne said, the invasion itself was launched from the area around Southampton, which made perfect sense. He was trying to go across to the Seine estuary on the other side of the channel. And so that was a good place to go. And we see him in the summer of 1415, actually at a number of places. So Wolvesey Palace in Winchester, that's the Bishop's Palace in the city of Winchester. And Bishop's Waltham Palace, which is another palace of the Bishops of Winchester nearby, are actually a very big, very, very, very comfortable palace out in the open country. He's staying there a bit. And I think there the significance may be that it was his uncle, Henry Beaufort, who was the Bishop of Winchester. So actually, you know, he's keeping it in the family. He goes to Titchfield Abbey, which is an abbey of the Premonstratensian canons, and stays there, it looks like, for about a week. So that's pretty good too. And I think quite a number of kings have done that before. I think Richard II had spent some time at Titchfield. But the big one that he's associated with is Porchester Castle. And it's at Porchester Castle that the English expeditionary force is actually mustered. And it's from there that they sail out through Portsmouth Harbour. Now, Porchester Castle is kind of an interesting one, and because it's a bit different to Kenilworth, in some ways similar, in some ways different. It was been very substantially rebuilt by Richard II in the 1390s, the very last years of Richard's reign. So it's kind of, you know, it's a bit like John of Gaunt's apartments at Kenilworth. It's quite up to date, but it's tiny by comparison. It's very, very compact. These apartments are, they're much, much smaller in scale, and they're grouped in a very sort of narrow little courtyard. So I think it's a place where probably Henry is doing business. But since we're painting the portrait of a king, you know, who likes his comforts, he likes magnificence, I think it's rather difficult to look magnificent at Porchester Castle. It just happened to be in the right place. And I think, it, you know, maybe I'm just sort of inventing stuff. I mean, who knows whether there's any significance about this. But the most successful previous invasion of France by Edward III, when he went off to the Battle of Crecy, he'd also gone from Porchester. I think, you know, probably this was for practical reasons more than anything, but maybe some memory of that previous glorious campaign from the English perspective had lingered on. And maybe there was the thought that actually this is a good place to come from.
My impression is, though, Jeremy didn't like Porchester very much. I mean, we can retrace his itinerary with quite a lot of accuracy. And yes, he goes to Porchester, and I think you're right. He sails, his ship's moored off Porchester. But I think he spends as much time as he can in Bishop's Waltham. I think he much prefers the creature comforts.
Well, it's also true that at Porchester, it's not a happy stay, this one.
Yeah. In all the planning that is about to happen for the Battle of Agincourt in 1415, there is a plot against Henry while he's on the south coast. Isn't that right, Anne?
Yes, it's called the Southampton Plot, and it is an intriguing event. Now, I said before that Henry had to persuade people to go on the campaign in France. There was quite a lot of arguments in advance. You know, the nobles wanted 6 months' pay in advance. The king only wanted to pay three, ended up having to pay six, and to pawn the crown jewels in order to pay for the second three-month period. So, you know, we assume Henry was always as famous and successful as he was to be after the Battle of Agincourt. Before that, maybe not. So there seems to have been a plot to depose him. Now, that's amazing, isn't it? Because you've got all these troops around, 12,000 troops plus others. But the plot seems to have been that the Earl of March would be put on the throne. He's from the second line of Edward III. And the plotters involved Richard, Earl of Cambridge, who is from the fourth line. And also a previous friend of Henry, Henry Lord Scroope, who'd served under him in the last years of his father's reign, when Henry had as prince controlled the government for a while, and also a northern knight, Sir Thomas Grey of Heaton, whose brother was very close to Henry V. So they seemed to be plotting to put the Earl of March on the throne and presumably to kill Henry and his brothers there. Now, it's one of these very, very odd plots. We have some confessions afterwards, and it's even been suggested there was no plot at all, that what Henry was doing was ensuring there'd be no trouble in the country while he was away by making an example of a few people. If this is the case, it's remarkably cruel of Henry. So I think there seems to have been some disquiet. And backing up that, a French spy was arrested later on at Harfleur, and in the trial of that spy, he'd met Henry, he'd come over earlier, as he knew the Bishop of Norwich, who was a friend of Henry's as well. And he'd said that Henry was more priest-like than a king. Also that, there was support for other rival claimants to the throne, the Earl of March, and that. So maybe. And also that Henry was worried about, or that there was anxieties that if he went to France, there could be trouble in England while he was away. So I think there was something. And poor old Henry Lord Scroope, the one who was closest to Henry, was probably attacked by Henry because he'd not disclosed the plot. You know, he'd known about it and he'd not disclosed. Not that he'd been a supporter of that plot. But again, it's significant because Richard, Earl of Cambridge, who is one of the people executed, all three plotters were executed. The Earl of March got away with it, although his relationship with Henry was not all that good, really, throughout the rest of the reign. But what's interesting is Richard, Earl of Cambridge, his son, and remember, he'd married into the second line, so it's the union of the fourth line, the second line. He'd married Anne Mortimer. The son of that marriage was Richard, Duke of York. Now, who is going to be the claimant in 1460 but Richard, Duke of York? So that plot, if you like, does have a link as well into the Wars of the Roses later on.
And the final thing is just the connection with the English heritage sites is that it is at Porchester, one of the sources says, in Porchester Castle, that the plot is actually discovered. So though it's always known as the Southampton plot, and it was actually, I think I'm right, that it was at Southampton that the accused were put on trial and were executed, but actually it's at Porchester that these things unravel. So presumably within this quite sort of tight, confined space of this little palace that Henry was living in at the time.
I quite like the alliteration as well as the Porchester Palace plot.
It's also interesting there because I think Henry was waiting to depart to go to France. I said he wanted to land on the 1st of August. So I think you're right. I think it's revealed at the very, very last minute, and that aborts Henry's plans. It takes almost another 2 weeks for the expedition to set sail.
That's really interesting, that. And a couple of really interesting highlights in Henry's life. For people who don't know much about Henry V, what else apart from Agincourt and this plot before Agincourt that really take up the rest of his story and of his life, Anne?
Well, I think we've got to remember that after 1417, he's hardly ever in England again. He lands on the 1st of August 1417, this time in Lower Normandy at the mouth of the River Touques. And he stays in France all the way through to February 1421. And he's even then only back briefly. He goes back to France in June 1421 and he's there and he dies in France in 1422. So he's a king away, you know, the first king to be away for as long really as Richard the Lionheart back in the late 12th century. So that's interesting. So we have England without a king, if you like, and it's probably just jolly good that he's so successful in France. Though by the end of his reign, people are getting a bit fed up with the costs of war. And in some of the later parliaments, he's not asking for money anymore. And while he's in England in 1421, he goes on a sort of fundraising tour up to Yorkshire through the Midlands and also to pay thanks at some of the shrines of the saints he's interested in, like John of Beverley and John of Bridlington as well. So that's an interesting feature. As I think I mentioned before, he was also the founder of monasteries, the last founder of such monasteries before the dissolution there. And those are significant. The House of Brigittines at Sion. The Brigittines were a very trendy order. They were run by an abbess, but they had men and women in them as well. So Henry was really up to date. It's a Scandinavian order. And some of his courtiers, particularly Lord Fitzhugh, were very connected with it. And he also set up a Carthusian house as well. And that was where monks were in individual cells. Again, very popular style of monasticism away from the communal monasticism of the past. And he was trying to set up a third house, the Celestines. He wasn't able to do that, but those are quite remarkable foundations. And he dissolved all of the, what do you call, the alien priories in England. All these places owned by Norman monasteries had been granted after the Norman Conquest. For instance, St. Michael's Mount was actually a priory of Mont-Saint-Michel in Normandy. He got rid of all of those foreign houses and he diverted all their revenues to his new foundations there. So again, an obsession with particular monastic foundations. Those are beginning in 1414 there and survive through to the dissolution of the monasteries. In fact, Sion is very interesting because you can still see its foundations, which is below Sion House, the house that became owned by the Earls Dukes of Northumberland in later centuries, just on the north bank of the River Thames, north of Kew Gardens, effectively.
He sounds a little bit like William, Duke of Normandy, William I, the absent king, but really keen on the pushing the religious agenda and setting up monasteries. Is that fair?
Yeah, good point. Oh, yes, as well. In 1421, when he's back, he also holds a meeting of the black monks, the Benedictines, towards their reform. You know, so he has a great interest in the church. It's quite interesting there that French spy, he said he was more priest than king. And also this idea of thanking God all the time for the victory at Agincourt, that is also, I think, quite significant. And what Jeremy was saying about, you know, him using the plaisance, and that we see this in the celebrations or commemorations of Agincourt a year later, where it's implied the king goes off alone, you know, to ponder what had happened and to give thanks for all of this. So I think we get very much the inner man in all of this with Henry, and Kenilworth really adds into that part of his character.
But he has a really unfortunate end, doesn't he, in France in 1422. Doesn't he die of dysentery?
He does indeed. I mean, it seems pretty horrible. It's starting to show in the summer of 1422. I mean, not everybody in France accepts the Treaty of Troyes, accepts his position as heir and regent. And so he's got some pretty difficult sieges there, although he wins all of them, but he starts getting dysentery and becomes weaker and weaker, so weak, you know, he can't get on his horse and that. And they take him to the castle of the French kings at Vincennes, the great tower of the 13th century connected with Louis IX, and he dies there on the 31st of August 1422, the same day, incidentally, as Princess Diana died in Paris. And that Vincennes is well worth a visit. He used to be shown the room in which Henry died. I think it's on the sort of second floor of an amazing tower house, quite a luxurious building, really. Charles V had spent quite a lot of money on it, had a library there in the late 14th century. So again, quite a luxurious place, but a place of horror. Given that, the heir to the throne was no more than 9 months old at that point in time, Henry VI, being born to Catherine, maybe, as I say, conceived at Kenilworth in the Plaisance in 1421, born in December, early December 1421, but hardly in a position to take control of the monarchy at his father's death at the end of August 1422. So going to need a regent, going to need quite a lot of people running the show until he's around 16.
And how old was Henry V when he died in France?
Yes, he's about 36, not very old at all.
And buried in Vincennes, as you say?
No, part of him was buried. Like all these people, when their bodies needed moving back to England for proper royal burial, and so his entrails are buried there. And there was a question in Parliament several years ago asking if the British government had any plans to bring Henry V's entrails back to England. Clearly it didn't. But no, he was brought back to England, having been mummified, essentially. And he was processed through northern France, Normandy and brought back to England, processed through southern England and buried in Westminster Abbey. He'd laid down his will in 1415, just before he set sail for France. The will, in fact, was made in Southampton or dated Southampton, and that had set up a great chantry chapel for him in Westminster Abbey, and that was subsequently built. It wasn't finished till the 1430s, but there is a splendid tomb behind the reredos in Westminster Abbey, so you couldn't see it at the coronation, but it's behind there, and it's quite remarkable, the decoration of it added later. There are two scenes, two coronations, presumably Henry's coronation as King of England and his would-be coronation of King of France had he lived longer. It's quite a remarkable structure, well worth a visit.
As we wrap up our discussion about Henry V, the final act, so to speak, in his lifetime, not the play, how was he actually remembered during his lifetime? And then afterwards?
Well, there are quite a lot of chronicles written in the period of his lifetime, but quite significantly, he had Latin Lives written about him in the late 1430s. I think these are probably connected with the final structure, the tomb and the chantry chapel in Westminster Abbey, and those are amazing Latin Lives. We don't really have them for other late medieval kings in that way. He was remembered as a great warrior king, and also a man who had elevated the star of England, if you like, above those of other nations in Europe. You know, he is remembered with a hugely successful person. Of course, as time goes on, the reality of it was that he'd overstretched English resources, and it was impossible really for the English to keep holding on to France, particularly when there was a rival claimant, the final Dauphin, Dauphin Charles, you know, who'd been put aside at the Treaty of Troyes in 1420. So that's always going to be a problem. And so you could say, whilst famous sort of in his lifetime and immediately beyond and seen as a success, as time goes on, it's pretty obvious he's sort of not acted in the best interests of England. And indeed, the wars in France go pear-shaped by the 1440s, 1450, and they are linked to the origins of civil war in England in the Wars of the Roses. So the longer-term legacy, I think, is less positive.
It's an interesting thing, though, of course, to try to do the counterfactual history of if, you know, Henry died before everything went horribly wrong. And it's just the question about whether if he had lived, what might have happened? Because in some senses, exactly as Anne has said, that the reign had set up an awful lot of problems, you know, which were enormous and intractable. As you say, they'd been massively overreached and that France would be impossible for anyone to hang on to. And yet, you do have to say that also, you know, I know some historians believe that, you know, it's not over-egging it to say that he's one of the more able people that's ever sat on the throne of England. So we just don't really know what might have happened if he hadn't died at a young age. It's just impossible for us to know. But of course, what did happen was that without him to hold everything together, Henry VI, you know, was an infant at the time, so there were regencies. But as time went on, all of these uncles from this enormous extended family did fall into factional infighting. And of course, eventually what that turns into from 1450s and 1460s is the civil wars of the Wars of the Roses, which are basically a dynastic conflict between various branches of the royal family, as we have discussed at other podcasts in this series.
Mm. And Shakespeare's treatment of Henry V, it focuses really on his glories, I suppose. Is that right?
It does. But I also like it because it makes Henry think, doesn't it? You know, when he goes a little touch of Harry in the night and all of that, he's actually the character, if you like, is thinking very hard about everything. I like that sort of dimension of it, yeah.
I think that there was a generation that saw Henry V through the Laurence Olivier film, you know, which was, you know, very significantly just at the point when the D-Day landings were going to happen. So it was celebrating, you know, a very successful historic invasion of France. And that is talking about the glories of going to war. But, you know, it's been notable from the 1980s onwards that the play allows for a much more nuanced reading. Yes, we have the contemplative Henry from The Night Before Agincourt. But also, you know, if you like, you could see some pretty contemporary themes in the way that it's put, that in the way that Shakespeare writes it, Henry is almost being played by the authorities of the church in England, who basically egg him up to go to war as part of a deal in which he's going to stop coming down hard on their own finances.
Which didn't happen. He taxed the church very heavily.
Sure. And you know, and likewise, the way that they write about the Southampton or Porchester plot, as we should call it, you know, there's a very human thing that Henry is personally desperately wounded by what he sees as the treachery of, you know, these people that he's grown up with. And so this revolt of thine is, methinks, another fall of man. You know, it's terribly grand. One thing that I just like to ask, and Anne can sort of talk about this, is, of course, what Shakespeare also writes about is an incredible orator with amazing linguistic powers, and whether the real Henry actually can justify that, I find fascinating. But, you know, the point that I, you know, just to lead into this is that, you know, as we discussed, the real historic Henry did a bit of very clever reply to the gift of the balls, you know, about I'm going to turn these balls into cannonballs and you will, you know, feel sorry, which is, you know, Shakespeare puts it in, you know, into grand language. So he was capable of, you know, that kind of thing. But could he have given the Crispin's Day speech that Shakespeare wrote for him?
Yes, well, he certainly said something. I mean, we have loads of versions of what he said. These speeches are invented, but they're as a part of a classical topos of the battle speech. Oddly, we know very little about the capacities of kings to make speeches, because in Parliament, it's always done by the Chancellor on their behalf. You know, when they're sort of saying the king's going to go to war and he needs money, dot, dot, dot. It's always done by the Chancellor. There's very little that the kings actually say. In negotiating surrenders of towns in Normandy, it's all done by somebody else on his behalf. And then the townspeople are eventually admitted into the king's presence. But there's nothing said there about what the king says. I think kings were much more aloof. That's the problem, of course, with the Shakespeare portrayal of Henry V, the boy next door kind of thing. You know, kings were much more aloof and inaccessible than in that play. But it's a great play in all kinds of levels. And I think Shakespeare's creation of Henry, and also linking out the transformation of the youth of the Henry IV parts 1 and 2. Mm. I think it will always be a very compelling picture of a character in a play, if you like. And it's significant, you know, that the Henry VI plays begin with the dead Henry V. Really, it's seen as the death of Henry V, premature death, is seen as the beginning of the problems for the English.
A short life, I suppose, but one remembered in different ways, both by Shakespeare and by chroniclers and by historians like both of you. So I think that's really interesting that he sort of has this multi-dimensional legacy, which will continue to be talked about and debated long after we've gone. So
absolutely.
I think that's really fascinating and a really nice ending to our discussion. So thank you very much, both of you, for talking to us.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. I've enjoyed it very much indeed. Mm-hmm.
You've been listening to the English Heritage Podcast. Next week, we'll be back for the start of the new school year in England to reveal what education was like at our medieval abbeys.
Several of our monasteries, we know that there were boy choristers there, so there was probably a schoolmaster teaching them the very basics in Latin grammar and also how to sing the services.
Thanks for listening. See you next time.